of the Sunday School lesson for July 5th.
Heard this lesson this morning. I thought we'd have maybe the slimmest crowd of the year for July the 4th. I didn't know we were going to be desegregated. We're starting out on a new series of lessons at the beginning of this quarter. We're going to take some of the books of the Bible and study the different books, rather, of the Old Testament, I should say. And this, today, we have the subject, A Nation Under God. And we start out with the book of Deuteronomy. Some judges, when they're sworn in office, open the book to Deuteronomy. And it's a very appropriate lesson, I think, for a 4th of July lesson. You know, when in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses is making his speeches to the people. In Numbers and in Leviticus, God was speaking to Moses, so to speak. And we come to Deuteronomy. Moses is making his last message to the people. Moses is speaking to the people. And he's telling them about the past. During the 39 or 40 years that they've been wandering in the wilderness. Speaking over here some 1,400 years before Christ, on the east side of Jordan, before they entered the Promised Land, because he never entered the Promised Land. He spoke about their great blessings, and he told them about the difficulties they would have and what they must do when they get there. Somebody has compared it to some of the Hungarians coming over on a ship to America after the horrible experiences of 1956. And one father spoke to the group. He said to them, "The Lord has been good to us. He's delivered us from the horrors of the Russian people over in Hungary. He's been given us a great blessing to allow us to escape and come to America." And then he went on to say, "But you've also read about some of the wickedness in America. And I would like to warn you about your conduct after you get there." How much like Moses speaking to the people in Deuteronomy. Now let me just review a few of the things over this, some six or eight chapters that are assigned to us. First place, Moses said over in the third chapter, "I pray thee, let me go over and see the good land that is beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain and Lebanon. But the Lord was wroth with me for your sakes, and would not hear me. And the Lord said unto me, Let it suffice thee. Speak no more unto me of this matter. Get thee up to the top of Pisgah. Lift up thine eyes westward and northward and southward and eastward, and behold it with thine eyes, for thou shalt not go over this Jordan." One of the greatest sermons I ever heard preached as a boy was the old preacher we had. I think maybe he couldn't read and write. But he preached on this subject, why Moses was not permitted to go into the promised land. And then we skip over a little bit where he begins to recount to them their blessings. He said, "Remember that thou wast a servant of the Lord, that thou was a servant in the land of Egypt. And that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord." This is the high point of all Deuteronomy, which the Jews go back to continuously. "And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up." And then he says over here in this same chapter what Christ quoted when he was tempted, "You shall not tempt the Lord your God as ye tempted him in Matthew." And then over in the seventh chapter, come on to what raises questions in some people's minds about what they say the cruelty of the Old Testament. It says, when the Lord said that, and when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, that is, the people of this land, thou shalt smite them, and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. For thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love upon you, nor choose you because ye were more in number than other people, for ye were the fewest of all people, but because the Lord loved you, and because he would keep the oath which he had sworn unto your father, hath the Lord brought you out by a mighty hand, and redeemed you out of the house of bondsmen from the land of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that the Lord thy God, he is God, the faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love him, and keep his commandments to a thousand generations, and repayeth them that hate him to their face, to destroy them. He will not be slack to him that hateth him. He will repay him in his faith. Thou shalt therefore keep the commandments and the statutes and the judgments which I command thee this day to do them. And then there's this other quoted clause that Christ quoted. Know thee that man doth not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. And thou shalt say in thine heart, my power and the might of mine hand hath gotten me this wealth. Thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto thy fathers, as it is this day. And it shall be, if thou do at all forget the Lord thy God, and walk after other gods, and serve them, and worship them, I testify against you this day that ye shall surely perish. Now, Israel, this other quoted passage that Micah quoted, and now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul. He doth execute the judgments of the fatherless and widow, and loveth the stranger in giving him food and raiment. Love ye therefore the stranger, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God. Him shalt thou serve, and to him shalt thou cleave and swear by his name. You know this, we talk about the law of Moses, tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. We forget sometimes that this is one of the most spiritual books of all the whole Old Testament, and that there is in the Old Testament so much that is profound, it goes far beyond, I think, what we so often think of it as say. Now, way back when they had the original case under Stephen Gerard's will, 1831, Mr. Webster was talking about where charity began in the law. And he said it began over in the 35th or 37th chapter of Elizabeth, Act of Elizabeth. Mr. Binney, who was on the other side of that case, said, no, it started back in Deuteronomy. All these different passages, I can't read the others, I have time to do it. Charity began, the law of charity began way back in Deuteronomy. Remember the stranger, for thou was also a stranger in the land of Egypt. Well, I can't stop to read more, interesting as it is. Here was this man, Moses, himself born in captivity. For 40 years, he lived in Egypt. He was trained in the palace. He studied the science, arts of Egypt. And then he decided to go with his own people. And you remember, he had to escape. And he went up for 40 years in Midian. And there he worked in the field, tending the flock. And then the third 40 years, after the Lord appeared to him in the burning bush and told him he must go back and bring the people out of Egypt. And that 40 years, he's just finished as he comes up here to make his final report to the people. His final message, just as Washington did. And he just learned that he himself would not go into the promised land, so he thought it was necessary to give the instructions to the people about what they would do and what they would find when they got there. Prepare them for their entry. They've been wandering so long, only Joshua and Caleb and Moses of the adults were still there. They were new, and he had to remind them of the past and what their ancestors had gone through, just as we may stop on a day like this and think that America was not always a land of such a high standard of living. As Dr. Perry spoke here, when the pilgrims came over in the Mayflower, and half of them died in the first year, it wasn't always as easy as it is now. And so I say this is one of the most spiritual books of the whole Old Testament. Its style is wonderful. It's the same throughout. It was certainly written by the same man. And it has an exhortatory style, a kind of a sweeping, oral style, because, you know, people do not write and speak the same way, or at least very few people do. It's the spoken word. He didn't speak to them with mythological mysticism as the Greeks would at that time, as Homer did, almost a contemporary. But he spoke to them as a real man with a very true message, man-to-man message. Who was the author? Some people have disputed it. It's certainly the book was written away back there, because, you know, they found it and hid away in the temple in 621. It does not have the same style as Leviticus and Numbers, and could not have been written by the same person, I think. Ready to dispute about it, but I should think if Moses did not actually write this, it was nevertheless a transcription of what Moses had said to them. It is sometimes the very word means that it was kind of a restatement of the law, as we would say. He goes ahead, he brings up again the Ten Commandments, kind of a reminder. The Torah had been oral. They didn't have any written law. Of course, we didn't have any written Bible to go to. Just think, it's only in recent times, 1611, that the English Bible was printed. People lived for over the centuries without any written law at all. And then this very Deuteronomy, way back in the time of the Southern Kingdom, at the time Josiah was king. You remember they were cleaning out the temple. One of those terrible, strange things. They were cleaning out the temple, and what did they find? Well, they found the book of the law, Deuteronomy, in the temple, and the people rejoiced, and they had a great thanksgiving. They'd lost it. And of all things, that Hilkiah the priest would find the scripture lost in the temple. Like somebody said, it's like hiding money away in the Bible where nobody'd ever find it. Well, now, the Jews, one of the fundamental teachings of this whole book, the Jews were a chosen people. Now, what does that mean? Well, Moses scornfully rejects any such religious ideas as other nations had at that time. The star cults and the demon worship of Babylon, he does not even accept or refer to. The animal worship of Egypt, where he had lived. The nature worship of Greece, or the worship which later became prevalent in Rome, the worship of the emperors, he doesn't. It's far more profound than any of that. Or the stone serpent idolatry of the heathens in the land which they were to go into. God has saved this nation from slavery. He says it's a small nation, the smallest of all nations. It did not reach the superlative in any way, this little group of Jews. It didn't have the outstanding statesmen, not very many outstanding statesmen as some other countries had. Egypt, for instance. Greece had produced, and Babylon, some astronomy. They predicted eclipses even, up in Babylon. And there was the use of metals that the Philistines introduced. The Jews didn't learn about metals. no great philosophers in Israel as Plato and Aristotle 400 years before Christ, until the prophets came. I think they were great philosophers. It's a very small nation. Nothing to offer but their faith. And he's saying to them, don't lose your faith in God, because he's not lost faith in you. But the largest nations have not always been the most influential nations by any means. You can look back over history in Greece, small as it was, Sweden, the Jews, Scotland, those little nations which have contributed so much have not been big nations, numerous in any way. I remember a long time ago in one of the old bankruptcy hearings we used to have over in the old Louisville Trust Company building, and Judge Durrell was holding court one day, and there happened to be in this court, as is commonly true, a great many Jewish people. And Judge Durrell never lost his sense of humor, and he said to Emil Steinfeld, he said, Emil, what is the shortest poem? He'd break into any kind of a hearing for something that was humorous. And Emil said, well, I don't know, Judge. And he said, how odd that God should choose the Jews. Well, it is odd, isn't it, that God should choose a little insignificant nation like the Jews. But he had a reason. Yes, they were little. They were very little. I've got an article about the increase in population in the world. Some of the most startling things. You know, there are now more than 2.5 billion people in the world. An annual increase of 34 million people a year. 4,000 an hour increase in the world. More than one every second. A good-sized town, more than 90,000 people, is added to the population of the world every day. Now, the rate of increase is going up. We're increasing more rapidly all the time. It's accelerating, so to speak. Before the discovery of agriculture, about 6,000 B.C., the total population of the world was probably less than 20 million people. It did not pass the 100 million mark until after the time of the old kingdom of Egypt, and didn't reach 500 million until the latter part of the 17th century. When Shakespeare was living, there were less than a fifth as many people in the world as there are today. We'll even talk about that. There weren't many Jews. It was a very small nation at the time. And the whole world was relatively very small. Now, but the Jews never got quite a clear understanding of what it meant to say that they were a chosen people. God chose them as a means of bringing the Christian religion through them. They never understood. And throughout the Old Testament, they were so imbued by the fact that they were the best people, that they were the only people. And the great prophets and the great writers of the Old Testament kept trying to correct that impression. And they had the book of Jonah, and the book of Ruth, and the book of Esther, telling them in a very tactful way that there were other great people too. And even in Deuteronomy, you can tell that God did not mean to say to the Jews, you're the only people. Better, you're chosen for a duty, not only for a blessing. Now, the second point I want to bring up is it possible that God chooses nations as well as people? Isn't that a strange conception? You know, the old history has always emphasized political and economic factors in the organization of nations. And you remember when the First World War came on and Nietzsche, the philosopher of Germany, said there's no morality of nations. A little nation has something that a big nation needs, it goes and takes it, and they march it through Belgium. No politics. We need Belgium. We need to go through Belgium to get to France. There's no such thing as national morality. And we got off a little bit on that kind of a theory ourselves one time, and I used to be in school in Chicago, and they always had as a streamer across the editorial page in the Chicago Tribune the quotation from Stephen Decatur. My country, in her dealing with foreign relations, may she always be right. But right or wrong, my country. I've read it so many times and never ceased to be shocked that they would publish a thing like that. Right or wrong, somebody has paraphrased "My Country." When wrong, may she be made right. My country, when right, may she be kept right. These teachings are very profound, as I say. In the New Testament, we find Christ quoting from, we find so many quotations reflecting back to the Old Testament. And you know, in this book of Deuteronomy, we find the word love appearing over and over again. I challenge you to find it in the Koran. The word love. Not just tooth for a tooth, life for life, talk. And then to talk about this charity. Don't rest the judgment of strangers. Be charitable. Remember all as you were once a slave in the land of Egypt. wouldn't it be strange if there was no such thing as a chosen nation? When you stop to think, my, what a little nation could do if it was completely devoted. What amazing strides we could make in this country if everybody was devoted to try to make America as great as it could possibly be. We wouldn't worry about national debt. We could pay it off in a short time with economy. We wouldn't have to worry about anything in America if every citizen of America was devoted to make America what its ideal is, perfect cooperation. Why do we breathe and eat and sleep and drink? Because they are fundamental physical laws. There are fundamental spiritual laws just as important. And unless we drink and eat and continually communicate with the spiritual law as we do with the physical law, we cannot be a great nation. It's just as necessary for a nation as it is for an individual. And that's modern philosophy, not ancient philosophy. And then the third thing I want to ask is this. What is America? Essentially, what is America? We talk about it a lot on the 4th of July. You know, religious convictions brought about settlements in America. From 1492, when it was first discovered, until 1607, it laid here for over a century. And nobody did anything about it. They started coming over here when they came over here for religious freedom. That's why they came. That brought them here. The whole effort has been to secure freedom for the individual. That was something new. Never had happened before. It was untried. Will it succeed? The sovereignty of the people. Lincoln expressed it when he said in the Gettysburg Address that the whole test, whether government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall perish from the earth. It's been predicted that it will. Because just a few years before that, 6 years before that, Lord Macaulay had said that a democracy carries the seeds of its own destruction. Can't succeed. You'll have class against class. I've got the quotation, but I won't take time to read it. You remember, Lord Macaulay said it can't succeed. We're still trying to prove that premise. The government of the people and by the people and for the people shall not perish from the earth. You know, Carl Sandburg wrote Remembrance Rock. And he told in it about Judge Windham. He had a rock in his garden. And around that rock, he occasionally brought some sacred dust from Plymouth Rock, and he poured that next to this rock in his garden. Then he went over to Valley Forge, and he got a little dirt there, and he brought it in and put it next to this rock in his garden. And then he went to Gettysburg and got some more. Gettysburg. The battle was just breaking up 96 years ago today. And then he had a son that had died in the battlefield in France, and he went over and he got some soil over there. And he put that next to the rock in his garden. And he said, when people come and say, what's the use? I go back to that rock. And I get into the spirit of the past. Not to live in the past, but to say the future ought to be based upon such devotion as we find there. We sing, God Bless America. May Maybe sometimes we ought to say, God, forgive America, because we wander so much as the Jews did. And there's a little boy reciting that one time, and he sang it this way. Stand beside her and guide her with the light through the night from above. Not from above, but from above. And I think so much we get completely overcome with our mechanical devices. And instead of saying with the light from above, he said with the light from above. What is the American way? Talk about the American way. It's not a standard of living. The American way is not comforts and conveniences. It was born out of a will for freedom. You could take away all the comforts and conveniences and we'd still have the American spirit. It isn't that. The separation of church and state, the right of the individual. Faith in God as the creator, because our very Declaration of Independence says, in the beginning God created. Standing on a high hill one time, a man and his little boy were there, and he began to point out to the boy, and he said, look away over to the right. And look over to the left. Look all around. You can see so far. God's love is as great as all that. And the little boy said to him, why, Father? We're in the midst of it. That's the expression. We're in the midst of it all. And I got out an old sermon of Rabbi Stephen Wise on the subject of what is America. And he commented on the very things I've been trying to say. He said it's not a matter of birth or ancestry that makes us an American, not a type of government, not a geographical or territorial place, like England during the war. They said England might have to move over to Canada, but they would always be in England. It isn't that. That isn't what America is. It's not a region. It's an atmosphere. It's an ideal, a vision, yet unfulfilled. A dwelling together of men and women under the leadership of their own choosing. Free to pursue the ends of life as we see them. Bound only by the concern for the welfare of all. That's America. It's a religion. We serve America. Not that America serves us. Uniformity is the curse of democracy. Diversity is ideal. Not America for Americans, but Americans for America, and America for all the world, in the sense that we are pioneers in the spirit of democracy. Religion exists in the hearts of men. Our government exists in the hearts of men. Not a piece of paper up there, not a constitution or declaration of independence. It's the spirit of those papers in the hearts of men that makes us American. We were the first nation to recognize the rights of the individual and to protect the rights of the individual. Our nation has a short history. Its mission has not been accomplished. We haven't yet proved that we can do the things that we set out to do. I hope we won't fail. But I want to read just a little paragraph. What Woodrow Wilson said up at the speech in June 1916 to the students of West Point. This is what he said. America came into existence for a particular reason. When you look about upon those beautiful hills and up this stately stream and then let your imagination run over the whole body of this great country from which you youngsters are drawn, far and wide, you remember that while it had aboriginal inhabitants, while there were people living here, there was no civilization which we displaced. It was as if the providence of God, in the providence of God, a continent had been kept unused and waiting for a peaceful people who loved liberty and the rights of men more than they loved anything else to come and to set up an unselfish commonwealth. It is a very extraordinary thing. You are so familiar with American history that it does not seem strange to you, but it is a very strange history. There is none like it in the whole annals of mankind. of men gathering out of every civilized nation in the world on an unused continent and building up a polity exactly to suit themselves, not under the domination of any ruling dynasty or the ambitions of any royal family, doing what they pleased with their own life in a free space of land which God had made rich with every resource which was necessary for the civilization they meant to build up. There is nothing like it. That's America. And you notice I can't help. I speak of America. I speak of Christianity as being sort of twins that go together. Both follow the great ideal.